11 years ago, Matthew Shepard was beaten, tied to a fence, and left to die in rural Wyoming. Up next, his mother Judy talks about becoming a gay rights activist after Matthew's death. I'm Julie Burstein in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC support comes from Cox and Kings Travel, celebrating 251 years of travel within India, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Online at coxandkingsusa.com or 800-999-1758. Riverhead Books, publisher of The Wordy Shipmates by Sarah Vowell. Vowell's look at the Puritans reveals a highly literate, deeply principled, and surprisingly feisty people. The Wordy Shipmates, now in paperback.
New York City's own station. WNYC.
WNYC, 93.9 FM, AM 820, and WNYC.org.
The Metropolitan Opera supports WNYC and presents the fourth season of The Met live in high definition. On Saturday, October 24th at 1, Verdi's Aida with Violetta Urmana in the title role can be seen at BAM Cinematheque. More information, metoperafamily.org/HDLive. WNYC is giving away three pairs of passes at BAM for Aida, starting with the third caller to reach us at 212-433-9692. Please note, if you've won anything from WNYC in the past 30 days, you're not eligible for these passes. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today. 11 years ago, the world learned the story of Matthew Shepard, a 21-year-old student at the University of Wyoming, who was kidnapped, robbed, beaten, and tied to a fence post outside Laramie, Wyoming, where he was left to die. His killers targeted him because he was a homosexual. Since then, his mother, Judy Shepard, has become a prominent person in the fight for gay rights, telling Matthew's story all over the country and working to raise awareness about hate crimes. In her new book, The Meaning of Matthew, Judy Shepard tells the story of her son's life and about the media storm that she and her husband Dennis had to navigate in the years following Matthew's death. I'm pleased to welcome Judy Shepard to our show today.
Thanks for having me. Great pleasure.
You've been doing a lot of talking over these past few days, and you begin your book, though, first with a memory of receiving the news about Matthew, but then about who he was when he was a little boy. Why did you want so much to talk about who he was and what it was like to have him grow up with you?
Well, one of the reasons that we decided to do the book now is I wanted people who knew him as Matthew to actually meet Matt. He was never Matthew to us. He was always Matt, Maddie, Mateo, and to some of his friends in the Middle East, Matouche. So, but never Matthew. I thought people should know who he really was, and we could kind of get away from the iconic, seemingly perfect individual, because he was not that. And I felt it was a disservice to Matt to actually have that be the only memory of him.
And when we see a photo, and the photo on the front of this book is heartbreaking and beautiful, it is two-dimensional, and it seemed like what you were trying to do is bring that third dimension
right
to who he was.
Well, I want to remind people, you know, he was a real person who had family and friends before that night he was found. So, and I think we did that. I've talked to a lot of people who said they really felt like they knew him much better.
One of the things that I found as a mother myself very powerful is that you didn't shy away from the things that weren't so perfect about him, that you were willing to talk about the struggles that he had and the struggles that you had with him.
Right. He was a delightful child, and in those delightful moments, you tried to forget about the moments he was not so delightful.
As all our children are, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think it was important to his friends, especially his friends in the community, that they all know that he struggled with depression and, you know, the kinds of things, issues with self-esteem that so many members of the community face because society tells them that they're wrong. He struggled with it, and I just wanted to remind people to never give up, that this is, you know, things are changing, and Matt suffered from those things, too.
You also write about your own struggles as a mother and your own awareness about how you had a sense that he was gay from the time he was a young boy.
Right. He was about 8, I think, when I first began to realize I needed to pay attention to this. Perhaps he was gay. And I, you know, I don't, how do you, I, you know, decide that at 8 about your son? I really think that all loved ones know in the back of their head when their kids are gay. It's you just, you know, bringing it forward is sometimes the hard part.
And you, he came out to you, though, via a very long-distance phone call to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. He was a freshman in college. He was 18, and he called to tell me that he was gay. And my question was, Matt, what took you so long to tell me? And he said, Mama, how did you know before I knew? Well, I just had to tell him, you know, it's a mom thing, and you just figure that out.
Then he asked you, though, something very hard, which is, don't tell Dad.
Yeah. He wanted telling Dennis to be part of his process, so he asked me to not tell Dennis, but I told Dennis anyway, because I knew Dennis was not going to say anything out of rejection to Matt, but maybe out of ignorance that I didn't want him to hurt Matt. So I told Dennis that Matt was gay, and, you know, it was fine. I knew it would be. He just needed to get past the first, okay, well, maybe he just hasn't met the right girl yet part of it. So it was all fine.
And also from your book, it sounds like he had there, while you had a real sense of what was happening, he had no clue.
Yeah, yeah, he had no clue. At least if he did, he never acknowledged it to himself or anybody else.
When Matt did tell his father that he was gay, it came at a very tough period in your family's life, which was right before his death. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened on that family vacation?
Yeah, we lived in Wyoming the whole time we had the boys. They were born there and raised there. We'd never gone to Yellowstone, which is, you know, actually that's a really terrible thing to never go to Yellowstone when you live there.
Well, it's like those of us who never go to the Statue of Liberty, even though we live right here in New York.
There you go. So we took him, and he'd gone to a local tavern in Cody where we had spent the night before we went into the park, and got into a little kerfuffle with a patron. And he said to me, I thought I was back in Morocco. He'd been attacked in Morocco, and he said, I thought I was there. Everything seemed the same. I was so scared. And he accused this young man of attacking him, which he didn't, but in Matt's head, it was all happening that way. He was having these awful flashbacks. He just never really recovered from that attack in Morocco. It was just really tragic.
And in that attack, he was a high school student, and he was beaten and raped in Morocco.
Right.
How did you as a family deal with that when that happened? It must have been terrible for all of you.
Well, there's no difference in the situation of a man or a woman being raped, that vulnerable to society. He struggled with it the rest of his life. We thought he was getting better when he actually went back to Laramie, but I guess we won't know now, will we? He struggled with the depression and the flashbacks and post-traumatic stress. He was very anxious. He sort of lost interest in the theater for a while. And it just changed his whole life and ours, too. We tried to be supportive, but you're not really sure what the right thing is to do. You sort of have to take your guide from them.
You write very honestly, too, about the struggles that you had about money and things like that from a distance with him.
Yeah.
And it was so poignant to read about a phone call that you had with him to talk about money, because it sounds like you were very frustrated with
him. It was very frustrating because it was nothing new, really. Matt and money were like oil and water. He just had no sense of how to not spend it. And his grandfather tried to call him and got the message that the phone had been disconnected. So his grandfather called us, and I called Matt on his cell phone and just began to, you know, just sort of like, why are you doing this again? And it got really frustrating, and we were just trying to figure out how we could make him understand that this is not how you can go through life. And we'd had quite an argument. He hung up on me and actually swore at me on the phone. And then he called me back, you know, a couple of days later and apologized. He was feeling very guilty for what he had done, very, very apologetic. So when actually he was killed, we all felt like we were in a really good place with him. We didn't part on bad feelings or bad words, any of us. And we were so fortunate that's how it happened.
I know one of the things, your book is so moving and so, so sad and so powerful. And you write about the statement that was made after he died and how you said it's important to just go home and hug your kids and tell them that you love them.
Yeah, you never know what's going to happen. You should never part on bad words.
When you learned that he had been, that he was in the hospital with a devastating brain injury, what was it like to come into the hospital room and see him for the first time?
Well, we weren't even really sure it was Matt. He looked so different. His face was all swollen, unrecognizable, really, and stitches everywhere from the beating. And His ear had been detached in the beating a little bit and was, you know, so they had these huge bandages everywhere, and he was comatose with the posture and totally unaware, of course, and we weren't even sure it was him till we got much closer. You know, there's a psychological step that you take as a parent when you know there are things that have to be done.
And you were told you need to be strong because right. he can sense what's going on
exactly.
just energetically.
Right. The doctors it's really impressed on us that we need to be not convey that angst to Matt when we were with him. So you're very cognizant of you have to maintain your composure for him and to continue.
You spoke with the police officer who came to him after he had been discovered, who said he was so slight and small that she thought he was 13 or 14 years old. But she also told you something that gave you a tiny bit of solace in those days.
It's such a beautiful story. And we didn't hear it, you know, right away. She shared it with us later. When she came upon the scene after the 911 call from the person who actually found Matt, there was a doe, a female deer, that was lying in the brush close to Matt. And Reggie said she felt like that doe had been keeping Matt company that night. It was really beautiful.
When I read this as a mother and, you know, reading about your son's death and then reading about you really being involved in the work to bring the killers to justice, I wondered how you found the strength to be able to do all of that by yourself, because one son, your other son was in school, your husband was in Saudi Arabia, and there you were back in Wyoming without him.
Yeah, we had a great network of friends, and we were actually going through the trials, the investigation. The police department was so amazing to me. They were very forthright and honest and trying to keep me up to date and not have any surprises. We couldn't have survived the event without them. They were so compassionate and kind. It was really quite amazing.
I'm speaking with Judy Shepherd. She has written a book called The Meaning of Matthew about her son, Matthew or Matt Shepherd. It's from the Hudson Street Press. Another thing that I thought about, I could sense from the beginning of the book that you were a very private person, and that being a mom and being there with your kids and your husband and getting the best life you could for them, even though it sometimes was a struggle, was really your main focus. After Matthew's death, you were thrust into this spotlight. How did you manage that transition from very private person to now a public figure who was mentioned by President Obama last week?
Well, I'm an introvert off the scale by nature, so it was a struggle. It was a family decision. Somebody had to do this work. We all felt very strongly about that. We had the opportunity to do it, and thanks to the Human Rights Campaign, we had a national stage to do it. We just couldn't let it go by without taking advantage of that. Help Matt, his friends, his community, and you just figure out a way to make it work, right? I wouldn't really call myself an activist. I'm an advocate, maybe, and a mom with a story. But it just had to happen. I had to figure out a way to make it work.
Was there a moment at which you realized this is not just our tragedy, this is a tragedy that has repercussions all over the world?
Well, actually, I think there were several of those aha moments, because it just kept getting bigger and bigger. When we first got into the States from Saudi, we saw the newspaper headlines talking about Matt and couldn't for the life of us figure out why it mattered to anybody but people in Wyoming that this was happening. And then we heard in Europe and the news sites and CNN International, and it was overwhelming. And then we began to hear about all the vigils being held around the country and marches, and it was just remarkable, the output of love and sympathy for the family about Matt.
When your family decided that it would be you who would do this, how did you feel, you to carry this on and really be the public presence?
Well, high school speech class was my worst nightmare. So I wasn't really sure that I could ever do this and speak publicly and make any sense. I was really hesitant. I wasn't sure I could, but I had a lot of support from some terrific people who just sort of gave me the nice shove out onto the stage and said, "We know you can do this, and we know that you know you should do this." So they were there for me whenever I needed them, and it just, I guess it just worked.
And from reading your book, it sounds like Matt was one of these people for whom this would not have been a problem, that he was someone who could have made friends anywhere.
Oh, my gosh. You just had to sit down next to him in the chair, and he'd talk your ear off. He just loved people and hearing different cultures, different languages, different points of view. He just loved people.
So much has happened in this past week. How have you felt about the bill that was just passed in the House bringing in support for people who are victims of hate crimes if they're gay?
Yeah, it's a huge step. I believe it's the first pro-gay federal legislation that has passed in history. And I'm overwhelmed with feelings of relief that it's finally, this is the furthest we've ever been, and everyone's thinking this is it. It's going to happen now. It's going to be signed into law. It's just like now we have something to build on to ensure we have job protections, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell can be addressed, and even DOMA repealed. So it's just, it's an amazing, amazing feeling.
I've been speaking with Judy Shepherd. She's the mother of Matthew Shepherd, and she's written a book called The Meaning of Matthew. Hudson Street Press is the publisher. And we have just a few seconds left. Where do you hope to go from here yourself?
Well, I'm looking toward the next step. The next step in getting the gay rights, civil rights, all of them taken care of. There's no reason why any American citizen isn't granted every single right every other citizen is.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.